I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to take a tour of Indiana's political past. Our guide will be Andrew E. Stoner, author of Campaign Crossroads, Presidential Politics in Indiana from Lincoln to Obama. The book is filled with fascinating, some of them nearly forgotten, episodes in the Hoosier State's history. Please join this conversation. Give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about some fascinating parts of Indiana's political history. Our guide is author and native Hoosier Andrew E. Stoner. Those of you with long memories may recall his name and a lot of other connections. He's written several other books, but also served in Indiana state government and in other capacities, often as a spokesperson, and has been part of the life of Indiana for quite some time. He's now a professor in California, but we're glad to have him back. Andy, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Great to be here with you.
I probably ought to do a disclosure here, and that is that Andy and I graduated from the same program. He's a Franklin College journalism grad as well, and he is back for some events at Franklin College. So not that that is any earth-shaking revelation, but I don't want somebody wagging their finger. The title of his new book is Campaign Crossroads, Presidential Politics in Indiana from Lincoln to Obama. So, Andy, tell me a little bit about the genesis of the book. Where'd you get the idea?
Well, I think my inspiration probably goes all the way back to when a very nerdish 13-year-old kid, I was following newspapers by then very closely, and Gerald Ford was going to come speak in my hometown of Goshen, and I was very excited about that. And, of course, none of my friends were excited about it, and my brothers and sisters didn't want to go. So I talked my mother into dropping me off at the high school so I could go hear Jerry Ford speak. At that time, he was a former president. I was very excited and pleased to see how the community came together to hear him speak. And then, of course, working in government and politics, I had occasion to see other presidents speak, and just noted that towns really kind of go all out when that sort of presidential politics comes to town. And I thought that might make a nice organizing principle or theme for a book, and decided to go all the way back to the oldest. And the book actually covers...
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, it's somewhat mistitled because you start before Lincoln.
Right. We go back to Martin Van Buren, and we have other characters in there from before Lincoln. But Lincoln being the most prominent Hoosier on everybody's mind politically. Lincoln visited Indiana first time as a candidate in 1844, campaigning for Whig candidates down in Spencer County, campaigned on horseback. So,
and how long did it take you to do the research? Because I'm amazed at the detail. And, at some level, I'll start with a disclosure in that in part because many of the latter parts of the book, like you, I'd kind of lived.
Right.
The stuff I found really, really fascinating was a lot of the 19th century stuff. Like, I'd never heard the story about, in effect, the bandstand collapsing under U.S. Grant
yes.
when he was here at
right.
Logansport, or anything like that.
Well, I was either well liked or hated in the interlibrary loan department at the university where I worked, because I sent away for microfilms as many as they'd let me have at one time, because I was out of state doing this research, and then of course. Did a lot of archive diving and found a lot of helpful people at archives that would share speeches, have original speeches in many cases. Notre Dame was very helpful because every president really, since Franklin Roosevelt has visited Notre Dame, so I was able to get a lot of wonderful information from them, Indiana University likewise. So it was just when you live and breathe politics and journalism, this seemed like a natural fit to me. And I was very interested in particularly how newspaper journalists covered these events. And as we know, journalism was very partisan in the 19th century and the early 20th century and evolved a bit. Mm-hmm. And maybe we're going back. You could argue we're going back that way. Mm-hmm. But so you have to look at all accounts if you can.
We are talking with Hoosier author Andrew E. Stoner, Andy Stoner, about his new book, Campaign Crossroads, Presidential Politics in Indiana from Lincoln to Obama. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So what were the hidden gems that you found? I mentioned one of them, mm-hmm. but when I read that section, and admittedly, I don't know a ton about sort of the Grant era other than, you know, a lot, the corruption and all of that was supposed to accompany his presidency. And then, obviously the end of when he was succeeded, how Reconstruction ended and all of that sort of stuff. But that was just one of those really, really human details that I thought, okay, that's the sort of stuff that does make history come alive.
Well, and he was a reluctant public speaker, didn't like to speak at length, and was returning to the United States after he'd been traveling around the world, several countries. And there was some effort to see whether they could convince Grant to run for the Republican nomination for a third time. So some of this was a bit of a test run. The Logansport incident, where the stage collapsed while he was speaking. He thankfully delivered short speeches anyway. So one of my favorites, I really liked the story of Harry Truman sneaking away in the night to go up to Noblesville for a Masonic temple initiation for a young man who had worked on the Secret Service detail with him in Washington, D.C. And Truman had run across this fellow in the crowd at Kokomo earlier in the day and learned from his father that he was being initiated as a Mason. So Truman's folks successfully got him off the presidential train that was resting in Indianapolis that night and took him to Noblesville, and he participated in that initiation ceremony. There was a fatality at a event for Herbert Hoover in Madison, Indiana, when they fired off the 21-gun salute that set off an explosion and killed a young boy there, and the Hoovers wrote a note of condolence to the family in Madison. It's interesting, Hoover's also an interesting story at Napanee, Indiana, which is in the heart of Amish territory in Elkhart County. Campaigning there in 1932, and a lot of Amish showed up, and he's encouraging them to tune in on their radios tonight to listen to his speech. And of course, they don't have radios. They weren't going to be able to hear the speech.
So, in digging these things out, what insights, did it change your perceptions of any? Because one of the things about being president is that you sort of become almost a caricature, and you get reduced to almost statue size. That's not reduced, but hardened into a statue, and it's real hard to see the human being behind it. Did you find that your perceptions of any of the presidents who came through Indiana changed as you did the research and the writing?
Well, I would say, for example, my opinion or my feeling about Benjamin Harrison rose quite a bit. There's a wonderful collection of his speeches, and he gave, just dozens of speeches from his house here on Delaware Street in Indianapolis, mm-hmm. and just some really heartwarming, beautiful speeches. I really love the one where he's got a group of school kids, and apparently he and his family were one of the first in Indianapolis to have a telephone in their house, and he's inviting the kids in to see the telephone, and he received a group of black Civil War veterans who come to support his candidacy and spoke very fondly to them, and so I really appreciated him. Lyndon Johnson was quite an interesting example in terms of it seemed painful or it seemed painful to read his words. Mm-hmm. And I know he had some wonderful speechwriters, Bill Moyers and some other guys, but he's here in Indiana, for example, in 1966 to celebrate the state's sesquicentennial, 150 years. And but just can't seem to shed the topic of Vietnam. It's coming up in all of his comments. And even when he's dedicating a wildflower garden at the Jeffersonville Post Office, one of Lady Bird's projects, it comes up again. It's talking about Vietnam. I was just very touched by how he seemed to be really overwhelmed with the subject. And then, of course, there's better-known situations. Robert Kennedy's speech here in Indianapolis is noteworthy. I think Lincoln's question to the people of Indiana about what shall become of the Union as he's on his way to the presidency was also very, very noteworthy. William Jennings Bryan made some very big speeches in Indiana, ultimately was everywhere in Indiana. He and Theodore Roosevelt, I think, visited every city in the state. His Cross of Gold speech was recorded, actually, at a studio in Richmond for a phonograph record. So,
we are talking with Andy Stoner about his new book, Campaign Crossroads, Presidential Politics in Indiana from Lincoln to Obama. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or check us out on social media. So the episodes, obviously, that that people think of with Indiana politics, the Robert F. Kennedy campaign, because that was crucial, and he was campaigning here when Martin Luther King was killed. To some degree, I suppose the Obama-Hillary Clinton primary campaign in 2008, because that really was the one that decided the nomination that year. What are other significant episodes that we've sort of erased from our historical memory here, things where Indiana mattered on the national stage?
Well, one of them I think gets overlooked a lot is the 1976 Republican primary between Ronald Reagan and Gerald Ford. Reagan came out of North Carolina and Texas with victories, but had never put together a primary victory in a northern state, and he beat Jerry Ford in Indiana with a very populist message, but also a lot of people thought probably drawing off the last of the George Wallace vote, moving them over into the Republican primary. And that kept Reagan alive all the way to the convention in Kansas City that year, where it was a very narrow victory for President Ford for the nomination. I think that George Wallace, I mentioned him, by the way, both the Wallaces, Henry Wallace and George Wallace, have had kind of a rough time in Indiana, and that's quite a few stories that about Henry Wallace not being able to find speaking locations because of his positions about in the late 40s and his association with Paul Robeson and so forth.
Well, George Wallace actually was a pretty potent force here.
Oh, yeah. He in the 1972 primary came in a solid second to Hubert Humphrey with 42% of the Democratic vote. So
and he'd run pretty strongly here in 68 and I think even in 64.
Yeah, he was in the 64 primary as well.
Challenging.
Matthew Welsh was standing in for President Johnson that year.
Well, and that's a part of the state's history that also people don't get as often. There would be these favorite sons or stand-in candidates, which, you know, we tend to think somehow of the past being a more simple time when, in fact, voters had to be fairly sophisticated to understand, in this case, a vote for Matt Welsh is actually a vote for Lyndon Johnson.
Right, and that was repeated again in 68 with Roger Brennigan was standing in for Johnson. But by the time the Indiana primary came up, he was actually, I guess, standing in for Hubert Humphrey at that point because Johnson had withdrawn.
What part of the book was the hardest to research?
I think anything having to do with 19th century stuff is very difficult to get primary source material on is very difficult. So there are times when you rely on the work of other authors, but I always credit them. There's some wonderful authors who've looked at some of these early campaigns in Indiana. Hoosiers have been very interested in voting ever since they've been able to. Even when we're talking about a horse and wagon era, people showed up to vote. It was an important task for them, even in the earliest days of statehood.
The 19th century, in part, you mentioned you start with Martin Van Buren. Did it get easier as the 19th century moved forward?
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, the easiest of all is the most contemporary. And I think that 2008 primary you mentioned was a retail primary, which I think most people thought was dead at that point. But you have Obama and Clinton working voters one-on-one in a way that most people thought was dead and gone by the modern era, but they were still doing it.
We are talking with Hoosier author Andrew E. Stoner, Andy Stoner, about his new book, Campaign Crossroads, Presidential Politics in Indiana, From Lincoln to Obama. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email, nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking with native Hoosier and author Andrew E. Stoner about his new book, Campaign Crossroads. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Brett has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Brett, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a Noblesville resident, and I perked up when I was listening to your show and heard Andy speaking about the president that came up for Masonic initiation in Noblesville. I also heard there was a presidential speech given from one of the buildings in the downtown area. And I'm not sure who the president was, but I wondered if he could clarify that and tell me if there was such a thing.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Brett.
Yes, there were many stops in Noblesville, particularly in the railroad days of campaigning. And there's one and I'm trying to remember which candidate it is who was amused to see that some of the inmates from the Hamilton County Jail were looking out the window or able to hear his.
It takes captive audience to a whole new level.
That they were able to listen in to what he was saying. But I'm looking real quickly here with Noblesville. Benjamin Harrison, of course, William McKinley, Theodore Roosevelt, and Sarah Palin all have appeared there from my research.
What are the hotspots, the places? I mean, Indianapolis, one presumes. You mentioned right. Notre Dame. Where are the places that are most often targets?
Well, that Richmond-Indianapolis-Terre Haute corridor mm-hmm. of the National Road is really the where so many candidates have appeared through the years. South Bend and Fort Wayne are prominent, but I would still say Richmond-Indianapolis and Terre Haute are even more so because of the railroad in that period. Notre Dame and Indiana have both have had many presidential candidates speak. In fact, Theodore Roosevelt's last speech in Indiana was at Indiana University at their commencement in June in 1919, and he had just donated a lot of his entomology collection to the university, which is still there in Bloomington. I would say those are the most prominent. In the old days, Gary used to get a lot of visits from candidates. Mm-hmm. That's probably not so in the modern era, but certainly up through the 70s, Gary was a frequent stop in Northwest Indiana, very important to Democrats in particular.
Yeah, it's odd because, we can talk. We're going to talk a little inside baseball here, folks. I'm sorry, but some of that is also the changing nature of things because Gary and the region are still very much retail politics sites, in part because to hit that with political advertising, at least until relatively recently. Social media and digital stuff's changed that a fair bit, but for much of the latter part of the 20th century and first part of the 21st, nobody wanted to buy into the Chicago media right. market because the rates were so high.
And we mentioned George Wallace. You know, he won Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties in the 1968 election and would focus his campaign a lot in that area. The areas, and he did the same in the Milwaukee suburbs as well. There were a lot of supporters. And these were areas where there's a lot of change happening, a lot of integration of new populations and people moving, and the white flight was really taking hold. And, of course, school desegregation was an issue. And so he found a ready audience up there. And I think that the importance of it has worn off over the years because of the vote has been moved south, you know, in Maryville and other parts of Lake County. But
how much did your background, and we probably ought to talk about, you know, how you came to this point in your life that, in fact, you were press secretary and wrote a book about former Indiana Governor Frank O'Bannon. So you'd lived in that world, too. You talk a little bit about the path that brought you to being an author.
Well, I think I've always went toward writing and politics, and I love the intersection of media and politics. I like being on that corner. There's a lot happening there. And even I think I mentioned when I was 13 years old, I was interested in it. I do want to say my first political job was with Marjo O'Loughlin, who's a Republican. And I just talked to her this week, by the way. She was 88 years old on Monday.
Oh, wow.
And Marge was state treasurer of Indiana, and I worked for her when I first came to Indianapolis. And so I feel like, and I actually went with Marge to the kickoff for the Bush Quail campaign in Huntington in 1988. So I was, Pia Isadora was the entertainment that day. She sang before they came out. But I feel like the that allowed me to see, I grew up in a Republican family. I worked for a Democrat. I feel like I could represent both sides pretty well.
Well, and more to the point, I think where I was going with the question is, you've seen it from both sides. I mean, you worked, you've obviously written about it, but you were inside the room often when discussions about strategy and all of that. What did you learn about how you approach telling this kind of story from those days?
Yeah, I don't know that I, because I relied a lot on the public accounts of the actual events, there isn't a lot of insider talk about. There is some cynicism. I think if you look at some of Reagan's visits to Indiana, his efforts on New Federalism, his tax proposal that he rolled out at Mac's Family Restaurant in Danville, it's kind of cynical to go into such friendly territory. You're not really going to get any real discussion of those issues in places like that. Nixon used Indiana a lot to his benefit. He dedicated a plaque for his mother down in Jennings County just as the Pentagon Papers were being released and the Watergate matter was really starting to heat up. I think he did so because he could count on a very friendly audience, you know, and he could draw a big crowd. The New York Times, even their article about it was that this was Nixon country, no doubt about it, that there are other parts of the country he would go and be booed, but not in Indiana. He could go and count on a very loyal, happy crowd. So there's, to that degree of cynicism, you know, just kind of using the state in that way. Reagan came to Kokomo in 1980 and did a rally outside the Chrysler and GM plants there on U.S. 31 and never came back to Indiana in 1980 for campaigning. But he did that on purpose. He came out of the Detroit convention and went straight to Kokomo to make his point about the economy and to try to draw over Reagan Democrats. And you know, that's all strategy. That there's no reason to be in Kokomo for any other reason. And of course, in that whole year, 1980, he never came back.
What was the period that you found the most fun to research? To, you know, that because we've done this kind of business, you know, at times, I'm sure the latter parts of the book, while they're interesting, you live through them. There is this sense that you've already visited it.
I felt like the 60s and 70s actually were my favorite part. I didn't; they were most informative to me. I feel like the 50s were such a halcyon period. You had Eisenhower and Stevenson twice, so it really wasn't that much of a contrast between those two races in 52 and 56. But Nixon and Kennedy were fully engaged in Indiana in 1960. The Kennedy people were convinced they could make some headway here. You see that with Lyndon Johnson, of course. He wanted every state in 1964. He didn't get them all, but he wanted almost all of them. And he was coming to Indiana with that in mind to turn back Goldwater. I think the 70s, where you have this huge crowd of Democratic candidates, this huge number of people who joined the race, is really rather fascinating to watch. And some of them quite interesting characters along the way, if you count George Wallace, if you count... I really enjoyed comments by Sergeant Shriver up at Notre Dame. I thought he really, and I hope people will look at this, Sergeant Shriver delivered a beautiful speech about that we'll pay a heavy price if we don't get engaged and we don't take the system seriously and get involved and hold our public officials accountable. And of course, Sergeant Shriver never got close to the office, but nonetheless delivered, I thought, some really important remarks.
People of our generation know this, but they're younger, probably don't realize that by marriage he was part also of the Kennedy
yes.
family, too. So that, that
and he was the McGovern's running mate in 72.
After Eagleton.
Yeah, the second choice, yeah.
The second choice after all of that. What was the most poignant moment, would you say, the most poignant story that you uncovered?
Well, I was struck by Franklin Roosevelt's discussion to voters in Indiana before and after the worst of the Depression, when he came back through Indiana during a drought, and it was presumably in support of his 1940 campaign. He was saying how he always spoke very paternally toward voters about, it's good to see that some of you are dressed better, you look to be doing better than the last time I saw you. It's interesting, his last speech in Indiana in 1944, he was en route to a bigger speech at Soldier Field in Chicago, but they stopped mm-hmm. him in Fort Wayne. And he talked about how, you'll find me the same as always, that my hat size is the same size as it used to be, and that we're in the middle of a war, and it seems like more than we can take, but I can take it and so can you. And that's why I say he's a very paternal sort of voice to the people of Indiana, and I think that's really what they wanted and needed at that time. I found it kind of heartwarming. We don't have our president really speak to us that way anymore.
Did you get the sense as you were moving through it? Because I noticed that in reading the book too, that the stories, the encounters, frankly, as the media managers, folks, image managers, and all of that, got more control over the candidates and the process, that the stories become a little more canned and prefabricated and all of that. One of the revelations is that it actually was possible to, at one time, for people to have, if not a full-blown relationship with their president or a presidential candidate, at least have a genuinely meaningful encounter mm-hmm. and with him. Until recently, they were all hymns. So.
Right. And I think the most striking example of that is Ronald Reagan came to Notre Dame. His first speech outside of Washington after he'd recovered from the assassination attempt was at Notre Dame's graduation. And it was coming just weeks after Pope John Paul had also mm-hmm. been wounded in a shooting. And really from there forward, Reagan was really never particularly accessible by people, always very managed. And I think you see that with every subsequent president along the way. The only exception to that, Clinton Gore's bus tour that came through Indiana the first time in 92 was a fairly casual event. But by 96, when they were the incumbents, it was, you know, very processed, very strict event where the access was very limited.
Well, and even in 92, and I'm referring to this because I actually was one of the guys covering when they were in Evansville, that struck me just how much image drove things. I was down there for the newspaper at the time, and they were doing an event, I think just north of Evansville. I can't remember the exact location, but field tons of people out there. And they stood up on the back of a pickup truck.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that was sort of canned. And they did a wave, and I think they did just a couple of real quick remarks. And then, you know, they were still relatively young guys at that point. They hopped down, and you could hear from the national TV crews, we didn't get the shot, we didn't get the shot. So immediately, they saunter back over there as if it's the most natural thing in the mm-hmm. world, and climb back onto the back of the pickup truck and wave some more.
Right.
Not really because the crowd was clamoring for it, but because they needed the TV guys. It was more important for them to get that.
Right. If only somebody told Michael Dukakis to get out of the tank in 88.
Or at least not put that helmet on
yeah,
or whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, what was the single funniest moment that you encountered in all of this? I mean, I chortled, obviously. I just can't imagine you know, in today's world, that if the grandstand toppled under a former president or presidential candidate, now what our reaction would be.
I think what struck me, Henry Cabot Lodge, who was Nixon's running mate in 1960, had a really rough day in Indiana. At South Bend, when he got out to speak to an audience at Notre Dame, when he got back, just before he arrived, someone slammed his hand in the car door, his right hand. So he stuffed it in his pocket because it's really aching. They actually did stop at a hospital and have it checked out. And so they go to Gary, their next stop, and he's trying to wants to visit with workers at U.S. Steel, but he's not allowed on the property. They won't, this planned event is not going to happen, so he's not allowed to. And then they finally rest for the night at their hotel in Gary, and the elevator gets stuck between floors, so he's stuck in an elevator for quite a while. So, and they said that Lodge was right after that was returning to Washington and was not going to campaign anymore that day. He'd had a rough day in Indiana. And that's funny, our friend Robert Taft also survived an elevator fall in Elkhart, three floors from the third floor to the basement in Elkhart in 1952. So he had a rough day too once.
We are talking about Indiana's role in presidential politics with Andy Stoner. He's the author of the new book, Campaign Crossroads, Presidential Politics in Indiana, From Lincoln to Obama. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Greg has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Greg, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I'd just like to, full disclosure, I'm a friend of Andy's. We served together in the old Bannon administration.
Okay.
But I'd love for him to comment a little bit about, the predictability of Indiana politics as far as voting for the presidency. And President Obama did win Indiana. So I personally feel it's not always the case if people would show up, frankly, but I'd love to hear his comment about that issue as well.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Greg. Yeah, what he's referring to there, obviously, is that Barack Obama won Indiana in 2008, and the last time a Democrat had won the state was 1964. So,
and before that was 1932 with Franklin Roosevelt. So that's the gaps are wide.
Yeah,
for the Democrats. And it's not for lack of trying. I think the Democrats have viewed Indiana as competitive throughout several of those cycles, but it ended up not being so. And I think that if you look at 32, 64, and 2008, those are either change cycle years, or in the case of 64, it was an affirmation of President Johnson following President Kennedy's death. So it may have been a vote actually for a deceased president. But I think that... really, the state is not much of a battleground to this point. The nomination, potentially, I think we've been surprised recently the last 2008 and in 2016 that it was competitive and that people were actually here campaigning.
Well, and Trump went over the top here.
Right, and that it's surprised people that that's actually been a factor. But I still think it's if everybody turned out, I don't know. We'll see. Heavy turnout has been beneficial to the Democrats, but it's like the opposite in California. I talked to some of my Republican friends in California. They'll say, well, I don't bother to vote because it doesn't count here. So you have that phenomenon everywhere, it seems to me.
Well, and something, we're coming up on a break here, but one of the things since your background is in media and you talk about how you like to live and work at the intersection of media and politics, that I'd like to talk about is the role newspapers played in covering and in some cases making breaking. Because one of the things, when I worked at the Indianapolis Star and News, one of at least the folk tales was part of the reason Lyndon Johnson won here in 1964 is that he was close friends with Eugene Pulliam, and Eugene Pulliam wanted to see his friend do well in Indiana, whether or not that was the case or not. We are talking about presidential politics and Indiana's role in presidential politics with the author of a new book, Native Hoosier, Andrew E. Stoner, Andy Stoner. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or check us out on social media. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking with author and native Hoosier Andrew E. Stoner, who is back with us from his current residence in the state of California, where he is a professor. He's written a new book called Campaign Crossroads, Presidential Politics in Indiana, from Lincoln to Obama. We're taking a tour of Indiana political history with him today. Just before we went to the break, I sort of posed the question of how the role of media changed through all of this. What are your observations there?
Well, in the early part of the state's history, of course, every city had a newspaper, and it was directly affiliated with a party, whether it be the Republican or Democratic Party, or in some cases the Whig Party. In fact, Schuyler Colfax, who was a vice president from South Bend, came right out of journalism in Indiana and gained the attention of Whig Party officials and eventually Republican Party officials for his views. The newspaper played a huge role. That's where I think you have to read all of the accounts. Mm-hmm. I was amused. I was reading accounts about Stephen Douglas's appearances in Lafayette and the Republican paper talking about it being a dirty and unkept and an unruly crowd and very small and uneducated, of course, and the Democratic paper calling it the greatest crowd ever assembled in the history of Tippecanoe County. You know, the same was true with rallies in Goshen. I saw the Goshen Democratic paper would call the Republican rally a silk stocking affair all around, while the Democratic Republican paper's coverage of the Democratic rally would be quite critical, and all of them try to underestimate and say, well, no one showed up, basically. In the case of candidates, that they had to go through the streets banging a drum and getting people to come out to come see the president. In the case of Chester Arthur, for example, which might have been true, by the way, not one of the most noteworthy guys to ever be the president, but he did come through Indiana in his tenure as president.
Of course, when we were in college, my former employer, Indiana newspapers, often were in the ethics textbooks for their coverage of the 68 Democratic presidential primary. We've already alluded to that. Bobby Kennedy, Eugene McCarthy, and Roger Brannigan standing in for either Lyndon Johnson or Hubert Humphrey at the time. The stakes were high. The Vietnam War was raging. Then, kind of like now, a lot of Americans were angry with each other, it seemed like, all the time. Mm-hmm. In those days, newspaper endorsements were really cultivated. They were valuable, less so today. What point did that start to change, did you find?
I think certainly by the 80s, I think that's dropping away. It's less important to the candidates. Television's impact has become so huge by then. That's where they're meeting and greeting most of their voters. The Indianapolis Star, I think, has got to be historic for the fact that when Robert F. Kennedy delivered his incredible remarks about Martin Luther King's assassination in Memphis, the Indianapolis Star the next day ran a story on the front page about how much activity there was for young voters for Roger Brannigan. And they mentioned the Kennedy speech inside on a inside page. And, it's probably one of the most important speeches Robert Kennedy ever delivered.
And arguably one of the most important speeches in American history.
Absolutely. And the Star, showing its stripes, they were backing Brannigan and through that backing Johnson. I think there was no love lost between the folks who owned the Indianapolis Star and the Kennedy family.
No, at least that generation of the Pulliam
family.
Right,
I think that they understood. And, Wendell Willkie is a rise right out of that whole industry. Newspaper editors all over the country, including Pulliam, supported the Wendell Willkie's candidacy and as an outside force. And Willkie, by the way, I think, though, doesn't get as much credit as he should for being a really respectable candidate and raising some important points.
Well, and the thing that I find fascinating about him is that you know, there was a level of, I'm not quite sure what a zone of privacy that we just don't accord to candidates, because he was having an affair at the time with one of the Van Dorens, and he and his wife sort of reconciled, if not reconciled, at least decided they were going to present a united front as they were getting ready to seek the nomination. And one of the journalists asked her about, you know, we haven't seen you around a whole lot lately. And this is where that phrase started. She says, well, politics makes for strange bedfellows.
Oh, see, I wish I had that in my book.
That's where that began. We've got an email question from our regular listener, Ben. And if you want to join the conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Ben writes, it seems like there's been a rise in the Christian evangelical right in Indiana, but maybe your guests could comment on whether their influence is about the same or whether it's been growing lately. I always hear on the news about evangelicals' growing influence on our politicians, which I personally find worrisome, and I feel like I've heard about them ever since Mike Pence became governor. Can your guest share his input?
Well, I wouldn't really be able to address it in terms of the 2016 election, because that wasn't part of my research, but I think that the church in Indiana and Christians in general have been a powerful force, certainly if you look at the 1920s and their connection to the Prohibition movement, and unfortunately also the Ku Klux Klan movement in that period. You see a powerful force for politics in Indiana, and they were worked for their votes. I think that as religion has changed over the years, you see more conservative candidates like Ted Cruz and some others have come through here and sought to revive a lot of that support among far-right, I would call far-right voters. I don't know that I would yet be willing to say that they're the deciding factor. I think there's a lot of still good people who think things through, and Christian and all faiths who look at things from a variety of standpoints. And I think that's all I could say to that, really.
We're talking with Andy Stoner about his new book, Campaign Crossroads, Presidential Politics in Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Nathan has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Nathan, you're on the air.
Hello, and this question's for Andy.
Okay.
We used to be neighbors of Andy's when he lived in Indianapolis about 27 years ago. Andy, it's good to hear you on the radio. I've been following your career. You've come a long way, man.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
My question is, as far as, you know, the polarization between conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats, I know in Indiana there seems to be a big divide. It seems like the conservative Republican, which Republican doesn't necessarily mean conservative anymore, has become, you know, more vocal, and it seems like sometimes the Democratic or liberal side is a little bit less represented, or feels like it. Is it similar in other parts of the country? Are we still kind of a conservative bastion, would you say, or are we kind of demographically similar to other states?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Nathan.
Thank you.
My estimation of it, and that's just for a guy now who lives in California, so I, you know, take my what I say with a grain of salt. I think Indiana is still solidly a red state. I think there's been times it's become more purple, but I think when the state Democratic Party, for example, has been more activated and won more statewide races, as they did between, say, 1988 and 2000, with the Bill O'Bannon era, the state was much more competitive. But if you look at what Bill O'Bannon had to do, for example, they had to turn around a vote for the Republican president and flip it to the Democrat governor. And when O'Bannon ran it in 96 and again in 2000, we had Bob Dole and George W. Bush rolling up big victories in Indiana. At the same time, we were asking voters to, and we were at that time asking them to flip from Republican for president to Democrat for governor. So I think that nationally, and if you look at the congressional delegation in Indiana, still very heavily Republican. I think there's only two members from Indiana who are Democrats. The Senate seat here, I think, was a bit of an anomaly because you had a powerful incumbent knocked out, with Senator Lugar knocked out and by a weaker candidate. And so that Senate seat has flipped a little bit over the years.
Do we see that dynamic? Because we're seeing this in some ways. One of the revelations from 2016 was just how much the polls, P-O-L-E-S, not the number survey kind of polls, now drive the process. You know, we saw candidates who sort of staked out positions on the extreme ends do very, very well, whereas that might not have been the case 50, 60 years ago.
Right. There doesn't seem to be much nuance in the current cycle that we're in, and not a lot of crossing over. If you think about Clinton's candidacies, Bill Clinton's candidacies were always, as a new Democrat, he was mm-hmm. attempting to reach over the divide and find some common ground with more conservative voters. If you look at Ronald Reagan, looking at more what they called lunch pail issues to try to reach over and get some Democratic Union households.
Reagan Democrats.
Right, to come across and vote for the Republican nominee for president, which some of them hadn't done in decades and were willing to consider because of the economic factors at the time. So I think that there was more of that in the past, and we might go back to that too. I think we're just in a particularly polarized period, I think, right now, it seems to me.
So you made the decision, obviously, to just take this through Obama. Are you tempted at all to revisit the subject, you know, with the emergence of Donald Trump as kind of a new force? Because and I think I can say this without offending anyone on either side, America has never seen a presidential candidate quite like him before.
Right. No, I'm not interested in pursuing that with him, but I do talk. I could tell you, like, when I talk with my students, for example, if you think about Franklin Roosevelt being the radio president, if you think about Ronald Reagan and, to a degree, Barack Obama being the television president, then this president, Donald Trump, is the social media president. He can reach over the mass media to directly to voters. He can set the agenda for the day with just a 40-character tweet. And that's a power that we haven't really seen before. The manner in which he runs and governs is still fascinating to watch, and sometimes confusing and perplexing, and other times infuriating. So I think we'll be talking about him for a long time to come. His impact on politics will be big. I'm not sure his impact on the presidency will be as big as his impact on the political process. My hope is that the way he talks about people and his opponents will be something that will go back to other people saying, I can't support that. I can't abide that.
When you say that his impact on politics will be big, in what ways do you anticipate him changing things going forward?
Well, I think the social media aspect first, mm-hmm. and then the second, just the type of language that he's been able to put across that is in older times and previous times would have been almost fatal to talk about a Vietnam veteran not being a hero, for example. I think there'd be plenty of people who would just cringe at such an idea of anyone talking about that, let alone saying that that's what they believe. Even speaking ill of his own party members. You know, the old 11th commandment in the Republican Party seems to be long gone at this point. They talk about each other quite harshly, particularly from the White House. So I don't think we've seen that. And that's because you have a guy who's come out of a system that is not, he's not come up through the congressional system. He's not been a governor. He's not been in the political system in that same way. And I think that the level of hand-holding and smiling through your grief next to people you may not like so much is not something he's used to.
Well, and we probably ought to talk a little bit about what you're doing back here in Indiana, because people all over the state listen to this. You are appearing this evening, right, down at our alma mater.
Yes, at Franklin College at 7 o'clock at the Napolitan Student Center. The Student Center, we used to call it the Lilly Center. It's got a new name now. At 7 o'clock, I'm also going to be signing copies of the book at Book Mamas in Irvington tomorrow evening from 5:30 to 8:30. And then at the end of October, I'll be appearing in Goshen for their Historical Society event and doing some events up in northern Indiana as well.
So I know this is the kind of question that every author dreads, because, you know, after you've finished one book, it's such a, you know, I remember the late Hoosier author Kurt Vonnegut once telling me that, you know, by the time he was finished with a book, he really never wanted to see it again because you've been through it, revised it, and done all of that so often. And he said that's what he loathed the most. The second question he loathed the second most was, what are you working on next?
Right. Well, and I'm one of those that I have trouble looking back over what I've already written, because I could see things that I would do differently or change or make better. But I have really already finished, it's based on my dissertation, a biography on journalist Randy Schultz. And Randy Schultz was the author of And the Band Played On, Conduct Unbecoming, and The Mayor of Castro Street, which was a biography of Harvey Milk. Schultz was one of the first openly gay reporters in a mainstream San Francisco Chronicle newspaper, mm-hmm. and very important figure in the 80s. He died in 1994, and he was the subject of my dissertation. And so I've got a biography ready to go if I can find somebody willing to publish it. I have it before a couple publishers right now. I'm still researching George Wallace in the North. I'm looking at Wallace's appeal outside of the South, and focusing primarily on Wisconsin, Indiana, and Maryland from his 64 to 76 campaigns. I think there's some interesting stuff there to work on, and I've always got something cooking.
Are you drawn to those? Because Schultz, you're right, was a major figure. Sadly, now he is in some ways almost forgotten,
mm-hmm.
At least in mainstream America. In the same way, it often seems, even though a lot of the themes George Wallace talked about, we find percolating back to the surface today, he in a lot of ways has been erased from from modern historical memory, too. Are you drawn to trying to find kind of those forgotten or at least eclipsed figures and restoring them kind of to their rightful place of attention?
Well, to a degree, and to the degree that they're helpful to understanding where we're at now, I think I am that very much so. I think that working with college students, you know this experience mm-hmm. too, they tend to think everything that's happened to them has happened for the very first time, and they're often interested to know, well, wait a minute, this happened once before. There's precedent for this, and I think that is valuable to look back and see and make those comparisons and the contrast with what's happening now.
Yeah, you mean that Lyndon Johnson and Herodotus didn't live at the same time.
That's right.
Kind of situations. It's not all ancient history. Well, Andy, I enjoyed your book. I should say that, and it is very, very good to have you back here in Indiana. I've enjoyed the conversation with you today. I'd also like to thank our listeners for some great questions, and I think some memories of Indiana politics as well. We're actually going to be talking with another Hoosier author on next Tuesday's show, which we hope you will tune in for. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.